everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
And I'm Alan.
We run ReverseThieves.com, an anime and manga blog and podcast site, where you can get 3+ blog posts every week, as well as various other podcasts, including our seasonal SWAT reviews, where we look at the first episode of a bunch of new shows of the season. And of course, you can get all the old episodes of the monthly Speakeasy Podcast there as well.
And if you have any questions or comments or show topics, please email them to us at ReverseThieves@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter. I'm HisuiRT.
And I'm NarutakiRT.
And if you like this podcast or any other thing that we do, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. It helps us go up in the ranks and contact new listeners. Let's check in with what's new on the blog this month.
This month on the blog, we have a couple of Makoto Shinkai-focused reviews. Al went to see Your Name, and then we realized that we actually hadn't seen
Garden of Words. And especially since Funimation is putting out a theatrical release of Your Name, if you wanted to get a idea if you should see it in theaters, I go out of my way to avoid spoilers, because I think the fresher you can go into that movie, the better. I did break it up into two parts. Even the second part doesn't have on full spoilers, but I did kind of want to avoid. And the killer turns out to be the butler. But if I say talk about the butler, you might then start looking at the butler more than you should, in that kind of respect. So, I mean, you could read the whole thing and not get spoiled, but if you're a little worried, I give my review and then I talk about a certain subject after the jump.
And I hope to see Your Name from this Funimation release. But yes, then we watched Garden of Words, which was the previous film, and we both watched that, so we did a joint review.
And I also did a rundown of Fate Complete Materials, which is the second Fate Stay Night art book, all about the characters. This one's a little more interesting because it has a lot of commentary on the characters and how they were created from the Type Moon staff. It's mostly Nasu and Takuchi, but some of the other guys chime in every once in a while. And I might do a little review in the future, a very quick review of the art book that comes with Fate Extella. Ongoing investigations. What we've been reading, watching, and playing. So we do our season reviews, and every once in a while, me and my roommate decide to check out a few series that we don't watch SWAT reviews of. Just like, let's like give this an episode or two, even though it's probably, there's probably a good reason that it wasn't on our to watch list. And we've watched some real stinkers because of that. But I feel like with Shinibio, every once in a while, we come upon like some actually decent shows that we overlooked. So Pats, who was just recently on the podcast, jokingly watched we should watch Dragon Maid. So my roommate was like, challenge accepted!
This doesn't always work out well.
Oh, like I said, we watched lots of stinkers. There's been stuff that we have watched without you, Kate, that we, you know, that there were good reasons that you left it off the list. We only usually, once again, like a SWAT review, watch one episode and we're like, oh god, why did we watch that dreadfulness? But I would say Miss Kobayashi's Dragon Maid, for a lot of reasons, is better than it should be. So the general premise is there's a young lady who is a computer programmer for a software company, and she wakes up one day and there's a knock at the door before she's getting to work, and there is a young lady in a maid's outfit with dragon horns, and she says, all right, because of our agreement, I've decided to take you up on your offer and be your maid. And she's like, what the heck? And it turns out that when she went to an office party and got drunk on the way home, she found this dragon who had like a dragon killing sword in it, and she saved the dragon.
She's very productive when drunk.
Turns out that she's like a maid fan, like of Emma maids. Like she reads lots of like maid fiction and the such. And so she, in her drunkenness, is like, you should come and be my maid. And, you know, basically stumbles home and wakes up the next morning and is like, all right, I vaguely remember that. And so after a little negotiation and her realizing that she's super late because of this conversation for an important meeting at work, she's like, all right, just fly me to work. And she's like, all right, that was actually useful. I guess you could stick around. And so basically they start living together and there are other dragons. And it's actually surprisingly funny. Reasons why you wouldn't think this is good show. One, if you just like look at the art, it is a little fan service-y. I mean, basically all the dragon girls are kind of as...
Wait, there's more than one?
Yes, because she has dragon friends.
I see.
I'll get into them. So as she says, I'm the cup for dragon. So this manga, I didn't realize this till I looked it up today, is written by the same author as I Can't Understand What My Husband Is Saying, which is like, wow, those are two very different. Do you remember that one?
I remember it not being funny.
Yeah, no. Well, once again, very different subject matter. I did not find that other one funny at all. I didn't know that going in. I think I would have like actively avoided that one knowing her previous work, but it's actually pretty solid. So yeah, those two things. But I feel like this one has a lot of good laughs, a lot of like research on dragons. Like there's a Toru is not particularly, but she's like friends with Fafnir and Quetzalcoatl and some like other like dragons that you know. It's actually a little cute because the second dragon that shows up is Kana, who basically is a little dragon who basically got kicked out of her house for being too troublesome. And so she lives with them and they become like a little family as, basically Kana's like, you're my mom. And Toru's like my older sister. And they kind of have a little bond there. It has a good mix of funny with basically Toru comes from essentially like a sword and sorcery fantasy world where it's dragons against humans. So she doesn't trust humans because they're always trying to steal her treasure and kill her for being a dragon. But she's learning to, what do you call it, like humans through Miss Kobayashi. And the like Fafnir, who's this, old classic, you know, Scandinavian dragon. He's the one from, you know, the Ring Saga and all that. He's like her mentor. And, you know, he's always like the first time she calls him for advice, he's like, kill all the humans, you know, destroy any who would touch your treasure and curse all of their generations. But, you know, hanging out with Miss Kobayashi and her friends, he kind of learns to maybe not hate humans and the such. But, I mean, a lot of it is, you know, just the antics of her being kind of from this, like, fantasy world and trying to learn the mores of the human world. And also, I think it's interesting that Miss Kobayashi is, like, a computer programmer. And so there is a decent amount of, like, talk about her office life and, like, her, like, having to come home late and, you know, because she's working on a big project or, you know, her having to deal with being a lady in, like, a tech-dominated field. And so, I mean, they did do it from a humorous angle, but it does touch upon those ideas. And clearly, either the author or somebody in the staff was a computer programmer because they talk about like spaghetti code and high level stuff. And it does seem like somebody had an experience being a programmer at one point. It feels a little drawn from my real life experiences. So that's definitely an interesting angle of it.
So how much is this series about Miss Kobayashi and the dragon, and how much is it dragon antics?
So, it's about 50-50. Like, the best way to put it is, So Kana has not been to, like, the mundane world too much. So they're going around. So when Miss Kobayashi once goes off to work, she's like, don't worry, I'll teach Kana about the human world. So they're going around and she's like trying different food and like, oh, what's that, Miss Kobayashi? And, you know, she's like trying to teach her the polite society, basically the modern world. And so it's kind of, so there's a little bit of her stuff at the office, Miss Kobayashi, and, you know, interspersed with, I hope they're doing okay, and her, like, problems with, like, a shitty boss. And then, at the same time, you know, they're doing dragon jokes, and they go to, like, a park, and they see a seesaw, and she's like, Miss Kobayashi, what's that? And she's like, oh, and she points to a seesaw, and she's like, that's how human children learn to use aerial attacks. It's how they practice catapults. And, you know, she imagines this thing of them putting on a rock, and then this child uses his super skill to jump on it and then throw the rock at this flying dragon. And then later on, when they meet after work, she's like, no, children play with that. And so they have this scene where they're both using the seesaw and they're just like jumping up into the stratosphere as they both, the two dragons, use the seesaw on it. So it's a little like, it's a little bit of, they try to mix in both in most of the scenes. They do have like a few like almost omake jokes to like break up the main stories, and those usually are just dragon silliness. Although sometimes there are domestic jokes as well. I think my roommate put it best as in probably the thing that drags the show down the most. Like, it's a little fan service-y at times. And it almost feels like the show isn't confident of its, like, touching moments or comedy. So it feels like, oh, we've got to have all the girls other than Miss Kobayashi be, you know, oh, va-va-va-voom and the such, and I don't feel it needs it, but sometimes you can tell that some joke shows like lean on their fan service, and I think the show does that, which I don't feel it has to, but I mean, I think like also in the first episode when Toru first appears, like two or three times they have like the boob bounce sound effect. I'm sure you've seen that thing, and they don't use it past that, but like, I don't think they've ever used it past the first episode, but it does just reek of that, like, look, man, look, if you're not liking the other parts, there's boobs, and there's bot, and come on! And
not subtle.
Yeah, it's not it's not Flying Witch, where it's like, once again, a lot of people were like, what? That's a fan service show? I'm like, it is. It just isn't in your face about it. And so you can ignore it easily if you want to. This time, yeah, there's at least like usually one scene per episode. I mean, they had an episode where they're like, come on, let's just face it. This is the fan service episode. Let's just get it out of the way. That's pretty much like the title of the episode. So they're like, they go to the beach. They go to Comic-Con.
Say no more.
And they're like, yeah, all right. Here's the like mega fan service episode. We're done. We've met the requirements. So let's move on. But I mean, that is going to turn some people off, or like, convince them that they never want to watch the show. And like, I get it. Like, once again, I wish that the show had a little more faith in its other aspects, because I think they're really good, but they do lean on that crutch. And there's she has a friend at work who's like, they're like, it's us against the company. And he knows about the dragons, and he eventually takes in Mr. Fafnir. And they have a lot of like bro bonding moments as they both turn out. He basically turns Mr. Fafnir into basically like his otaku buddy, because he like generally convinces him like otaku's hoard treasure, and like he's like, all right, I can get behind that.
The modern equivalent. That's funny.
And so they basically start living together, and they also have a lot of like good, like fun, kind of touching moments. Because he also basically teaches Fafnir to like trust humans as well.
So now ongoing investigations is going to be mostly taken up by talk about Breath of the Wild. Because I got the Switch day one, and I've been playing absolutely as much as I can, and I still have done nothing. That's how I feel playing this vast game, but I desperately want to talk about it because it's on my mind constantly. When I'm not playing, I'm thinking about playing and wishing I was playing. When I'm at work, I'm mildly distracted.
They're like, Kate, why is this cover got this guy in like a green hat that has a ball?
He's climbing a mountain. What is up with this?
I wanted to go in a very different direction with the cover.
Yeah, so there's so much talk about it, and it's just our time to add our two cents, I feel. And I didn't know a heck of a lot going in. I watched the launch trailer for it and knew immediately that, of course, I needed to have it just like everybody else. And I've avoided all other information really about it, luckily, and I haven't had any spoilers or...
So you don't know that you've been Ganon the whole time?
It's a total surprise. It's really nice to be going in so fresh to a game. And, well, I feel as though I've been able to do this a lot more recently. I'm getting better at it. So with this, though, I'm a huge fan of the Zelda franchise. The only one I have not played is Skyward Sword. And I always look forward to, you know, what they're going to come up with next. And this is... It actually really threw me off when I first started playing it. I knew that it was going to be different. I knew it was this huge open world experience. But first of all, I've never played a game like that. I've never played Elder Scrolls, or I've never even played WoW or any of these games that clearly are partially inspiring it. And then also it feels as though it's the more perfect version of Ocarina of Time in a way that, had they been able to do this, this is what I feel like a lot of this would have been, that because that was the first Zelda where you had such a vast open space to explore. Yeah, for me, it's a really new experience because I have not played all these other games that have aspects of that.
Yeah, no, I feel that... Like, the common talk is that it's borrowed so much from its own history and other games of the time. Like, people are like, oh, you can see the stamp of, like, once again, people are like, oh, this is very Dark Souls-y, this is very Skyrim-y, this is very from this Zelda, you know, this from the original Zelda, from, you know, Ocarina. Everybody then almost always prefaces it, but in a good way. It doesn't feel just like... like this weird Frankenstein creation. It's actually a very skillful blending of all those ideas from those other games. And I feel like that's, you know, really taken off with a lot of people's imaginations. Especially, I think, the thing that strikes so many people is that, especially since you've complained about this a little, if not on the podcast, just to me in... you know, in our regular conversations, that a lot of people, including Kate, feel that a lot of games are very hand-holdy in the modern era. Like, they don't trust you to know what to do. So, you know, to use the classic Zelda line, hey, listen!
And you know what? At the beginning of this game, when you're what I was calling the tutorial plateau... which, by the way, the tutorial plateau is so large that that would be the whole game of some other game. But when you are confined to that one section, there is a moment in there where the game says, hey, you should go here. And I said, shut up, Navi. And the game heard me. Because it never happened again. And... the cool thing, since you brought it up, Al, I'll mention it here, is the game catalogs for you hints that you get from talking to people. So someone will say, oh, I heard there's a great fairy fountain somewhere, wherever. And it'll kind of come up on the screen that you've heard this rumor, and then it'll go into your, I don't know, whatever, compendium of rumors that you've heard. And also... there's a device that you get at some point in the game where it will tell you if a shrine is close by, because this game has all these, like, tons and tons and tons of little shrines which are mostly puzzle based. But the great thing is about both of those things, they show up on your map, but you can turn them off. So I don't have those on. And the game does not force you to have the hand holding. And if you want, I'm not a person who is judging you. I definitely don't want anybody to feel like I think that nobody should have those things. I want it as an option. And that's what I've always wanted in all games, is I want the option to turn that stuff off. That's it. I'm not asking for everybody to play at the same pace or the same level, but I want that experience of figuring it out myself. And I was shocked to see that finally they listened. However, I will say that the reason that they do that stuff is because of their desire for this all-encompassing, all-ages type of thing. And this Zelda game does not feel like a game that kids could play. It is too complicated. It is too hard from the get-go. The game does not pull any punches from the very beginning.
Like, maybe I'm just remembering my old days of playing Atari, and then I feel like it's forgiving at points. Like, if you can deal with a little bit of frustration, I feel like it doesn't, like, Dark Souls, you know, you lose your progress and get a penalty for every time you die. So, you know, I feel like, I wonder how much would you sell kids short, or like, I mean, because I've done it too, of just like, if you give them a challenge, but will they rise to it? And especially if they're not, like, horrifically punished for failure.
I do appreciate that the game does not, it has auto-saving, so if you die, you can show up pretty much right where you were. You might not have certain things, but you can show up there. You can save anywhere on the map, which is nice. I guess the other thing, though, when I said complicated, is that I feel like the controls are really complicated.
Okay, that's fair. Definitely.
You know, original Zelda, it was freaking hard, but at least I feel as though the mechanism was very straightforward, even though it was very difficult. Slash your sword, whatnot. But even, like, it took me a really long time to get, and I still am not used to the controls. I'm constantly hitting the wrong button because there's 12 buttons that all do something.
I mean,
completely different. And maybe kids are just, maybe I'm just old or something. And you know what? No. Little kids would be, whatever, 12 buttons. That's no big deal. I can do it. Old ladies just can't. And I'm like, you're right. It was me. I don't know. But I had a lot. I struggle with the controls. And it's not because I think that the controls are bad. I feel for the most part, they're very responsive. But it's just very complex gameplay from my point of view.
Once again, when we were talking beforehand, I've played a little bit. I don't own a Switch, so I just basically have played a little bit when my roommate isn't using his Switch. I've watched my roommate play a decent amount, and you've played, obviously, as you've mentioned, a lot. Like, I didn't know that if you're falling and you shoot the arrow, you can get a little bit of slowdown time to aim. And, like, there's also, did you know you can surf on your shield?
I knew that, but I haven't done it because it damages your shield.
But, I mean, I feel like that's, like, a mechanic that, like, you could easily never know about, but is there if you choose to discover it.
From my point of view, it's just so much more complex than any Zelda game I've ever played. And the other thing about the difficulty level, which I actually like about the game, is the way that you can explore anything you want, but the way that they sort of hem you in is difficulty or you cannot fight that thing. And there's plenty of things on the map that I don't fight, but there's certain areas where you can't avoid it. But I like the thing in here that you can stealth, you can sneak by things, you don't have to fight everything that you come in contact with. You run into what I call mini bosses constantly, and you can run away and not fight them. And I mark them on my map so that I remember that when I'm running through there, that there's a scary thing that I can't fight yet.
And one other thing that I thought was a good thing is once you basically escape, not even after you finish the tutorial plateau, you get the ability to teleport. So if you ever find yourself like neck deep in like, whoa, I should not have gone down here, and now I've like flown into the mouth of hell itself, you can just teleport back to a safe location and go, once again, mark on the map, go back here when I get good.
And I guess that's more of what you were saying, Al, about how the game helps you in it's difficult, but you can get out of it and rethink your strategy very, very easily.
Because I remember in Final Fantasy II Japanese, it was actually really easy. Like, the map was actually pretty explorable, so it was really easy to get into a section, especially if you saved on the overworld, where you would just not be able to get out of again. And, like, basically, you'd have to restart your game or go back to an earlier save. And, like, they've definitely realized with the freedom to go anywhere, there is a distinct chance that you're going to, you know, wind up, oh, I just saved, and I'm bleeding in the middle of this shark-infested water. And you can just be like, teleport out of here, boop! Which I think you just have to do if you're gonna, like, make the map that open. And I think that's the thing that I think strikes everybody. Everybody I've ever seen play this or talk about this game is, you know, you get out of the very first seconds where you wake up and you're like, oh, I'm Link and I have to, and they're like, go here. And everybody I know goes, all right, where else can I go other than here? Because everybody tries that, and usually you find yourself hemmed in, and maybe there's a little bit of, you know, world you can explore until you get to that first point. But I think everybody's usually shocked that, like, oh, I can just do whatever I want. I can just go here whenever I want to. And, like, I think my roommate must have played for maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours before he actually got to that first point.
And the cool thing was with the exploration aspect of it, which is something that I absolutely love. I love that there is a focus on exploration. There's a focus on finding things on the map, marking them on your map. Like I said, if there's a big scary enemy, you don't fight it, you mark it and continue to explore. And that aspect is so amazing to me because, so I have two friends playing this at the same time, and none of us, especially at the very beginning, were doing the same things. We've done things in different order. We've found different things. You know, one person has found this thing. One person has found this thing. One person has found this thing. And it's crazy because we're basically all playing it at the same time, and yet we aren't in the same spot. We aren't seeing the same things all the time. We haven't been to the same locations. It's very cool to be sharing that experience.
And I think, like, the fact that, like, all three of you have, like, learned to, like, one of the things you can do is you can, like, catch a horse and ride back to the stable, and then you can get horses that you can ride around. And, like, I think each of you discovered the horse riding at different times and, like, have different amounts of experience with it. And once again, it's something that you can basically do the minute you get off the plateau. But, you know, it all depends on how quickly you go, all right, let me see, how close can I get to that horse? When I sneak up, oh, I can mount this horse. All right. Oh, I can stay on this horse. Oh, I can ride this horse.
And the more I play, especially at this point, I understand. But I feel like when I just started the game, I was still waiting for it to do certain familiar things. And the only really familiar thing that has really occurred so far is I had to go to Kakariko Village. Like, oh, Impa and that. And That was very familiar, but... And we have some of the same races in the map, so there's that familiarity. But otherwise, it isn't doing the things that I expect. Where's Epona? Where's this? Where's that? That's how I felt at the beginning, because I kept expecting there to be these things given to you. And they've done something completely different. And ultimately, I think it's a good thing. I do, like I said, I do find it a little complicated, the controls and the weapon stuff. It has weapon durability, which I hate. It's actually funny, I was mentioning this to some people before we were recording the podcast, that it's very funny to me that two of my favorite franchises, Fire Emblem and Zelda, have basically swapped, because Fire Emblem finally, for the first time, got rid of weapon durability, because everybody hates it. Even though it was a staple of the franchise, they finally did away with it. And Zelda, which has never had it really before, has added it into everything. So I just thought it was almost ironic. That's something I really dislike about it. That's probably my biggest complaint.
Yeah, I've seen... It's probably the most controversial choice in the game. I've seen some people really defend it, like who love it, because they really feel like it makes you use a lot more of the weapons as opposed to sticking to one weapon. Like, they feel like it really organically gets them to try different tactics, because they feel like otherwise they'd be like, all right, I'm just gonna use this one method that works and use it all the time. Whereas, like, you can't do that. You've constantly got to be changing up and seeing what this weapon does and what that weapon does. And then, like, a lot of other people have the problem of, like, it makes me, like, really, like, worried about stuff, and I end up, like, saving all my best stuff, and it becomes, like, this hoarding issue, and I'm, like, loath to use anything that's good, and, like, it makes me, like, also just really worried, because now I'm using all this, like, low-level junk, because I don't feel bad about using it, and it creates, it's interesting. I feel like, depending on what anxieties you have, it either, like, pokes at them in a negative way, or actually takes them away. It's a very interesting litmus test of the kind of player you are, of whether you really like it or really hate it.
The problem is the inventory for your weapons is so small, and the way that you get more inventory is, it's not complicated, like, it's fairly straightforward, but it's interesting because I have this, yes, this problem where, oh man, should I use this weapon because it seems like it's really good and I don't want to use it against random, you know, moblins on the map or whatever. But because your inventory is so limited, you can't hoard that much, because if you suddenly have an inventory of only things that you don't want to use, what are you supposed to do? You have to use them. I feel like if they have to have the durability, I don't know, I want some sort of better balance for it, I think, because there's certain things that you pick up that are good for fighting guardians. So guardians are the most terrifying creatures in this game. They're so, so scary, and there's very few weapons that can hurt them. Now, for the most part, I just don't try to fight them and run away. But there's certain parts where you have to, because they are blocking something important. So, but the weapons for that are hard to come by or really expensive. So I wish, like, almost wish the guardian weapons could be their own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, no, your guardian weapons, that's like all the ancient weapons, that's an unlimited inventory or something, or just its own thing. And this game also doesn't have, you don't have all your items. You don't have your hookshot and your boomerang. Well, you do have a boomerang, but it's bullshit and sucks, and it should be banished from the game. I want an update where they just get rid of it, because I hate it so much. They ruined my favorite thing. Well, now it's a regular weapon and not the magical boomerang that it once was. Because, so you don't have that stuff to worry about, because you don't have, like, a million things. But, yeah, there's just something about not being able to rely on your weaponry that drives me insane. And I feel like because you don't have items, well, so there's certain things that you owe, and that's the other thing. So there's certain things that you always need in your inventory. You always need a hammer. You always need a leaf. You always need an axe. So I feel like, oh, I wish those were their own. Again, something that wasn't counting against your weapon inventory, because you have to have those things around in case you need to do various things.
Like, from what I've seen of the game, there should be a weapon inventory, shield, armor, items, and then tools.
Yeah, something like that. Obviously, tools can double as weapons, so I understand why it's there. But yeah, I feel like because some of them are really only used in really specific situations, that it's a little bit frustrating that it takes up your mm-hmm. weapon inventory. Like, I have a leaf that takes up my weapon inventory, and I only need to use it in really, really specific circumstances. So I feel like that's my biggest issue, I think, is weapon durability. And like I said, I feel like the controls are really complicated, and it's hard for me to remember them all. I'm constantly hitting the wrong button. And the only other thing I will mention is that, so the game it just totally threw me off about how much detail there is in the game. It's just incredible because it tells you the temperature, tells you how much noise you're making, the weather changes, the time of day changes, every certain amount of days. There's a blood moon, and there's so many little details. It's very interesting. The fact that it rains is the worst. Lightning is scary in the game also and will kill you, but regular rain is also really frustrating because I don't, like, obviously it's a place where rain would happen because that makes sense. Weather happens. But from a gameplay point of view, it's terrible because I doesn't seem to add anything to the game. Like, it's not as if, oh, well, it has to rain, otherwise such and such won't happen.
Oh, well, I think certain, like, items and, like, creatures come out in the rain.
Oh, okay. Because mostly it's just like, oh, now I can't see anything, and also I can't climb anything. Thanks a lot for the fucking rain.
You know, they made a checkpoint joke just today of, like, well, I'm not going anywhere because I gotta wait for this rain to pass in the game so I can climb this thing.
Yeah, maybe it's just to make you take a break. Maybe that's why it's there, because Nintendo is big on telling you to take breaks from things, so maybe that's their way of doing it. Because if it's lightning, it's even worse than the rain. You have to go take shelter somewhere, and then you just have to sit there. So I get up, go make a sandwich, check, okay, everything, you know, oh, it's still lightning, and, you know, do some other stuff. So maybe that's their way of making us take breaks, because it is a game that is so vast. It's overwhelming.
I wanted to mention two things that I've seen a lot of people comment, and from what I've played, I've really noticed. And one is, we've generally touched upon it, but they have this mechanic which a lot of people groaned about at first, which is these very early on, these giant pillars raise up, and there's like a giant pillar in each section, and you usually have to, you're suggested anytime you enter a new area, find the pillar, go up there, and look around. That's actually a very common mechanic in a lot of open world games, especially Ubisoft games like Assassin's Creed and the such. The climb to the top of a tower in an area, get the map of the area. What usually happens is you climb to the top of the tower in the game or do something that essentially is the equivalent of that. And then you get all these quests and you get like a map of the area. And a lot of people have commented the odd thing about that is it actually makes you explore this open world a lot less, because you just basically have this checklist of where to go. So you just go to every place that's basically a quest marker, knock those off, and then move on and don't look at anything else. Whereas Zelda, you just climb up there And you just get a better vantage point.
No, you get a map.
Oh, you get a little map, but it doesn't have, like, doesn't have quests, doesn't have where shrines are, doesn't have where to go, who to talk to on those maps. It's just, like, a little bit of, like, very brief detail just so your map gets filled in. And you basically have to go, yeah, that looks like an interesting area. What's up with that?
It doesn't even show you towns. Doesn't show you towns, doesn't even show you stables, unless you have visited them.
So yeah, you have to go, I think there's a stable there. I'm going to check that out. What's up with those ruins? I'm sure there's something interesting over there. And then it like forces you to go there. And since it's just not a map and a marker that you know, a lot of people have noticed they tend to look around a little more. And so like if they go and check the ruins, if it was like an Ubisoft game, they'd go right to the ruins and do the ruins quest. But in this one, they're like, I find like three other things before I usually get to those ruins. Well, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to run over here for a little bit and see what's up with this circle of flowers. And then, oh, what's down in this cave over here? And those moblins seem to be up to something. Let me see what's up with them. And then after you do all that, oh, I guess I got to the ruins now. Or I've seen my roommate, like, I'm going to go, and I think there's a shrine over there. And then do, like, 12 other things and never get to that shrine. And that marker that he marked off is still on that map, but he...
Yeah, I love the way that side quests and shrines and the map are compiled. Like I said, I think they did a good job of you being the controller of just how much you know. I would be interested in seeing someone beat and play the game without ever getting the map from the towers. I think that would be really interesting.
Dude, you don't have to do that. In any way, it's just like, hey, look, if you want to climb that tower and see the map, go for it.
And sometimes when you go to climb that tower, bad things happen to you on the way. Sometimes not. Sometimes it's okay. Everything's cool. But sometimes it isn't. And I like that about the game is it's, I like that the game is not predictable because not every tower is done the same way. Some are in contested areas. Some are in fine areas. Some have enemies around them. Some don't. And the same goes for all kinds of different quests that you go on, or even I actually should check to see how many hours I have played, because I have not checked, but I played the game pretty much nonstop for about 4 days and then have played various times beyond that, and I have only done one major I fight a boss. I go to a dungeon, a real a familiar type of dungeon. I've done one. And I am just now on my way to getting the understanding and the tools to do a second one. But I have done so much other stuff. And the other thing that I just want to mention here is I love that this game requires you to be clever. I think that is amazing because tons of these little shrines, most of them don't have enemies in them, period. Some have one. I've now encountered one that had three, and that was crazy. And that was a big one, and that was the first time I ever used a key because we don't have keys and boss keys and whatnot. That's not, we don't even have that. But most of them are puzzle based. But they're not the puzzles that you have seen before so much. They are...
More the puzzles you maybe get one or two of in a dungeon.
Mm. But it's a game where you have to do a lot of critical thinking. You have to come up with, okay, how am I going to do this thing? And there's sometimes two or three or more ways you can do anything. Same thing with fighting any of the things on the map. My favorite thing to do is get to a high place and throw bombs at things. But you could also go down there and fight things, or you could shoot them with arrows, or you can blow up their camp or whatnot. And the same thing happens in shrines. It wants you to do it maybe in one way, but I don't like that way. So I'm just going to use a bomb or whatever. I use bombs a lot. I love bombs. Just use them for everything because they're unlimited.
Kate's the med bomber who bombs it. Because
they're at midnight. In this game, they're unlimited. So I appreciate that.
No, well, the other thing I was going to mention was the complexity of systems. Like the example that somebody gave me, which I thought was really great, is like you said, there's rain and thunderstorms. So basically what they did is they took off all their metal so the thunderstorm wouldn't hit them. And they went into this moblin camp where all these moblins were sleeping because they're just sleeping outside in the rain. They snuck over, they stuck a metal sword in the ground, and then they ran off and watched as the lightning was attracted to the metal and just zapped the living goodness out of all of the moblins in the camp. And then after they were dead, they ran in, collected the sword, and then gathered all the dropped stuff from the thing, and then just went into shelter until the storm passed. Or what my roommate loves to do is if there's ever a beehive around one of the camps, he loves to hit it down so the bees go and bother the camp, and then he rushes in while they're all, like, fussing with the bees.
Yes, exactly. Those things, exactly. It's a game where you can approach things from different ways. When there's a puzzle, I feel it takes some critical thought. It's not just move this block here. Sometimes it is, but oftentimes it's not. The first dungeon that I did, it relied heavily on critical thinking. And of course, me being me, I can't figure out the really easy ones, but the really hard one, I was like, I know how to do that. How do I do this? This is the baby easy beginning of the dungeon one. I'm like, I don't know how. But that's because the game is, I feel like, in a way, I sometimes want it to be more complicated than it is because some of them are so complicated. And I like that despite there being a lot of enemies on the map, the game is not filled with enemies, especially in dungeons. There's a few and a boss, and there was a boss. That could change. Like I said, I've only done one of what I assume there will be four, maybe, and then the castle maybe being five. So maybe there will be more enemies inside of these puzzles. Oh, the other thing, though, I wanted to say is that that dungeon gave me a 3D map, and it was horrible. What the hell, Nintendo? You guys need to figure that shit out, because that 3D map was the most useless thing ever. That was definitely a misstep. But again, I didn't even know about that for so long, because I was doing so many other things.
I mean, I think it's worth mentioning, I wanted to mention this all before we left, that technically people have already speedrun the game, that they've beat it under an hour, because all you technically have to do is complete the tutorial plateau, and you can technically race right to Ganon and beat him.
How do you have the tools, the weapon power necessary to do that?
So, like, apparently speedrunners know how to basically hit up the right enemies on the way to Ganon's castle to get enough
of the gear they need
to take him on. And they basically go with the three hearts that they have. And
that is crazy.
Such is the world of speedrunning.
Wow.
So, I mean, technically, yeah, you could beat the game in under an hour. In fact, like, they're racing to see how... Now the race is on with speedrunners to, like, how quickly can you complete the first plateau and, what do you call it, and get to the end. And, like, I just found out from Checkpoint, there's a controversy. If you use an amiibo to get a horse, is that cheating in a speedrun?
So, that's real. I have to look into this because I thought you needed the four artifacts. Because they send something to the castle.
I think they just make your job easier.
Hmm.
But technically, you could just go finish the plateau right to Ganon, beat the game. It's just incredibly flipping hard. But yeah, I think that I mean, but I think the other thing is that there's so much of the world to explore and so many fun and cool things to do. It's not like, oh, I guess I'll grind out this garbage so I can take on Ganon because I'm not a, you know, Dark Souls god who can, you know, take on Ganon with three hearts and whatever little bit of garbage I pick up along the way. I mean, I think the game is incredibly interesting. Like, it makes exploring the rest of Hyrule, going out and looking for these shrines, seeing where these four, you know, special dungeons are, seeing what is out there to find, who there is to talk to, all worthwhile. It doesn't feel like it's stuff that you have to clear out to get to the end. It's so compelling that even though it's not required, you want to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just an endless game. That's the thing that sort of frightens me a bit about it, is it's a game where I feel like I could theoretically never be done.
I mean, they already have one DLC planned that adds a whole new separate quest line on the map with new dungeons and areas and weapons.
I didn't know that. That's terrible. That's terrible news. I have to say, it's interesting also for me, because a lot of times with a game, I go straight forward.
Mm-hmm.
Depending upon how many times I think I'm going to play it or whatnot, a lot of times I'll just go, all right, I'm going to go do the things that I need to do to beat the game and see the game. And then, you know, maybe if I really like the game, I'll go back and I will do all this other stuff. But this game, that's all out the window. I need to climb all these mountains. I need to fly over the ocean and go to this weird desert island thing that takes all of your stuff and makes you fight things on the island using only your wits and the things you find there. I need to do all of those things. So it's a really cool experience for me. It's a first, and it still feels like a Zelda game, but that's a question that I'm going to be asking myself a lot as I go through. But I've met the Zora, I've just met the Gorons, and that bring some of that loving familiarity into it. So,
man, I know people like that Zora prince. He is
Sidon. He's great, and I really liked him too. I feel like the Zora look different every time, so you're not. They're similar. Obviously, they're always these fish people, but you don't know what they're going to do with them. They kind of change it up a little bit every time. Whereas, like, the Gorons, I feel, have looked the same always. So it's interesting that they're always playing around with some, but not the others. But yeah, he's really great. He's very funny. I also really liked the king. And there's so many of everybody. There's so many humans running around that you can talk to. There's so many Zora you can talk to. And half of them will give you random quests. And
you know, it's really interesting that, especially after the tutorial platform, like when people were initially reviewing the game on like game podcasts I listened to, like the question was, like, how many people are there? Because, yeah, I mean, you basically only meet Old Man Cookington, as I call him, in the plateau. So a lot of people were worried that there'd be like maybe one person per section of the map. It is a common question I heard.
Come on, guys.
And then everybody was like, no. Just get out of the tutorial platform and you will meet lots of people. There are multiple towns. There are people you just meet on the road. There are people.
Plenty. Lots. More than ever. More than any.
It is not just Sir Cookington and his two friends.
I guess I can't say that couldn't happen, because sure, there are oversights in plenty of games, but you know, come on. I think that I love it. I probably love it. I have so many things that I need to do. I'm writing my list in my head as we speak, but you know, it's gonna come down to how the story ends. So I love the gameplay. I love it conceptually, but Zelda is still a story, and they have to do the story justice, so I haven't seen the end of that, so my final verdict is not in.
I'm sure you can force yourself to talk about the game after you finish it.
Oh, well, if you insist, Al.
I do. I demand it. I'm not going to let you get away with it.
All right. All right. You drive a hard bargain. Okay, so I have started reading the Shonen Jump series Black Clover. I know that it runs in the English Weekly Shonen Jump, but that's much more ahead of where I am. And I've read the first three volumes. I have to say that I'm still really on the fence about it, but I know that I don't think that it's terrible because I've read more than one volume. I feel like I'm just still a little bit unsure of how much I like it. Like, do I like it a lot? Or do I just like, no, it's pretty good. And it's a fantasy adventure series about this kid named Asta. And he lives in a world that is basically ruled by magic. Everybody has magic for the most part. And there's all of these different systems of it in place. The government is all run by magic, and there's these knights, these magical knights, and their units. They're all kind of known for different things, and so it's like really prestigious to join them. And Asta is this orphan along with his best friend, and they're, you know, kind of just coming of age. And when you come of age, you go to this ceremony and you get your grimoire, which is your book, your magic book, and it picks you. So everybody goes to the ceremony. Asta is this very like Genki character, which I really like that type of character. And he's like, instead of I want to be king of the pirates, he wants to be the wizard king.
I have a quick question. Is this a world where everybody can do magic, or is this a world where only special people can do magic, or is it basically like a trade? Like, anybody could technically do magic, but you need training to do magic.
So I will say that, one, Al knows that I don't super delve into the minutiae of the way systems work. So the only thing that I will say about the magic use in here is that the magical world is really complicated. So, like, the entire thing is really complicated. So, from what I gather from the beginning is that, for the most part, everybody can use magic. How well they can use it varies. But pretty much everybody can use it. But, yeah, whether or not you're, you know, so good at it that you become part of this elite, or whether or not you, you know, like, live in the countryside, that's all I can really say about it.
Oh, it's just because I was actually more thinking of the Xanth novels, where everybody in that world has, like, a magic skill, but it varies from everybody. So, like, if your magic skill is, I can make a spot on the wall that has any color, then you're not going to be, you're just going to be a Joshima with a regular job because your magic power isn't cool. But if yours, I control the elements and the land itself, you're going to be an important person in the world of Xanth.
Yeah, it does seem like people's magic is somewhat custom to them. Like, certain characters have, like, certain spells that they use all the time. So there is some, like, not like, oh, everybody can do any kind of magic. Some are more versatile than others. Asta can't use magic. So he goes to the ceremony. He's, like, super devastated because basically, like, no book picks him. You know, he's like, wait a minute, like, I have this whole plan. What am I supposed to do? And once Asta is sort of, like, really devastated about this, a very strange book appears before him. It's really, like, beat up. It's a grimoire. So he's like, cool, I can use magic. Except what comes out of it instead of magic is this giant sword. And the sword has the ability to nullify magic. So it's an incredibly powerful weapon, but the grimoire that has chosen him is basically, like, the symbol of the devil or whatever. Like, it's like a, like, oh, wait, I think that's like a really bad thing. So it's this weird, like, we don't know exactly what he's been chosen for, because no, like, being has come out and been like, hey, this is what we're gonna have you do with, like, this, but we know that there's something very ominous about what has chosen him. And he has, like, zero magic, so, like, there's actually some really funny bits in the series where there's, like, this particular type of bird that seeks out those who can't use magic and just, like, pecks the heck out of them. Like, it just can sense your unmagicness. So Asta, even despite his inability to use magic, wants to become one of these elite knights. So him and his best friend, who are, like, rivals but best friends, and his friend is, like, super good at magic. And they you know, travel and they try out for this. And each company of the knights can choose. Basically, if you get chosen, you can stay. If you don't get chosen, you have to leave. If you're chosen by more than one company, you get to choose which company you want to be in. And Asta ends up being chosen very, very, very nearly not chosen, but chosen by, like, the super misfit, like, weird company. He officially becomes a knight, and he starts kind of finding out more about, like, what's actually going on in the kingdom, because he's from the countryside. He's pretty much, like, a bumpkin. So the, like, the complexity of the kingdom seems really like it's, like, a lot of stuff going on. And I think that's one of the reasons that I don't yet know how I feel about the series, because, like, I don't really know what the story is yet. Because by book three, we've met, like, a neighboring kingdom, and they also use magic, but they use magic kind of in a different way. And so they clash with them. So we know that they've tried to invade before. So, like, there's that aspect of it. You know, obviously, I said Asta has this weird book, so we don't know how that exactly plays. We've met the Wizard King. He's kind of a weird guy, but, like, he seems pretty, like, amenable to peasants becoming elite knights, whereas, like, there is, like, a lot of hierarchy and, like, aristocracy stuff going on. But yeah, like, it seems like a really complex world, and I just don't know, like, what the main, like, the overall plot of the story is.
It's definitely not put all its cards on the table yet. No.
It's like, I don't know. I mean, they've met some, like, really bad dudes. You know, there's just been, like, little, like, pieces of things that seem like they'll be the story, but I just don't know what it is yet. I really like Asta as a main character. Like I said, he's, you know, really, like, go get him. He's also got, like, really good facial expressions. Like, I think that the series has, like, some pretty good comedy in it. It is a series where it's not super fan servicey, but there's, like, a little bit of fan service. One of the other people in his company is basically, like, a Yankee guy. So, like, I feel like it has a lot of potential. Obviously, it's running and it's doing well. It's getting an anime. And I like that it's a fantasy series, because I feel like we don't really have one of those right now from Jump. So I think it has, like, a good start. But I feel like I'm reserving judgment, because I want to know what the major plot is going to be. But I think Asta as a lead is, like, really good. He also doesn't really have, like, a lot of a temper. Reminds me a lot of Luffy, except he doesn't have any, like, he doesn't feel like he has a lot of leadership ability like Luffy does. But, like, I feel like just kind of the way that he reacts to a lot of things feels very kind of,
Well, I don't think, like, he's also been thrown in a leadership role as well. I mean, he's clearly, from what you've been saying, like, a subordinate at this point, so.
But he, you know, he wants to be Wizard King, and so does his best friend, and they're, you know, both trying to, like, climb up the ranks. But
what's his friend's magical shtick?
Being insanely powerful. I mean, like, he basically gets this grimoire that, I think it's, like, a four-clover grimoire, and that's usually, like, the only people that get that, it's, like, a super rare one to get. And he joins, like, the most elite knights. So they're kind of, like, and he's like, just the complete opposite of Aston, pretty much in all ways, in everything, but they're best friends.
So what do you think has kept this one alive for three volumes, because we've
seen... And it's way longer than that.
Oh, yeah, because we've seen that Jump titles get murdered if they don't do well. So why do you think you're still on the fence, but this series has gone on? What do you think? I think that's, like, the question that interests me the most.
I think Asta's a good lead, and I also think the world is intriguing. Like, I think that's what's keeping me, you know, like, I feel like if the world and the characters weren't intriguing to me, there's no way because I'm waiting to get volume 4. So, like, I wouldn't read past volume 1. And volume 1 is a lot longer than what Jumpstart even gives you, you know? Like, that's, like, what, 10 chapters, but probably, like, one volume. I don't think that I would read past that point if it wasn't intriguing. And I think that certainly the first few chapters have that. And that's what you need. Like, you don't have to tell me everything. You don't have to do everything. And I think, because, like, Jumpstart, you get so little. But I think you just have to kind of show, like, basically grab people's interest. Like, okay, like, I want to know what's about to happen.
It seems like they feed you just enough of the world that you, like, get a general sense of what's going on. And basically, like, all right, you have the minimum information you need to know. We'll teach you everything else as we go along. Which is, I think, especially in the modern day, the way a lot of people like their stories to be told. Of, like, just give me the minimum and, like, slow, like, basically through context and, like, small things, tell me everything else as we go on.
Yeah, like, you gotta sell me on something else that isn't just, like, telling me everything right up front. I also think the art is really good. Very precise, delicate hand to it, and able to go from, like, comedic to action very well. I think that the visualization of the magic is pretty good. And Asta has a giant sword.
That's always a
I mean, it's like a basically like a giant gut sword, so.
Okay.
Oh, no!
Okay, so, in a way, I have to get this one out of the way. This is like my ramp down, because next month's going to be the super hard one. Because next month's Hayate's ending. So, like, I have to, like, kind of deal with manga ending by dealing with the end of Yamada-kun and the Seven.
Oh, I see. This is a practice.
Yeah, this is my practice. I love Yamada-kun. It's a great manga. But, like, my heart isn't ready for Hayate ending next month. Like, so, like, the universe was like, all right, Al, I don't like you and you don't like me, but we gotta work together every once in a while. So, I'm gonna let you down in stages. So I'm gonna end this one, and then you can deal with the real boss battle that is Hayate. And so, Yamada just recently ended. We've talked about that manga several times on this podcast. Now looking over, like, two series. After seeing, basically, the end of two series of Miki Yoshikawa, I like her writing. And I like how she changes the story every few, like, few books or so, she changes, like, the dynamic of the story, which I think is really great. It prevents the series from falling into a rut. The problem with both of her series that I've seen is she tends to go on one iteration too often, and then I feel like she has to wrap up her series after that. And not necessarily the best of places. Because I know a lot of people had problems with the Yamada Magane-chan ending. Because they felt it just abruptly, like, is forced to wrap up. And it kind of ends wonkily. And on a certain level, I feel like there's, like, the first major arc. And then there's, like, two more arcs after that. And then I wonder how much people felt like it wasn't working, and it feels like it has to finish up the story without it fully exploring the ramifications of those two new arcs. And I think much more than Yankee-kun to Megane-chan, she pulls out of being forced to end the series much better, but I do feel like somebody in editorial told her to just please end this. In that regard, I think she pulls up at the end very well. I think she realizes the most important thing is Yamada and Sarashi's relationship. And that's kind of the crux of the ending. I mean, anything else would really be super unsatisfying. And she targets the more important running plot lines, although I do feel like some of the lesser ones are just basically sweeping something wrong.
Hope nobody remembered that.
And it is very conclusive. I mean, they not only end high school, there's a time skip with two long chapters after that, which is pretty as flipping definitive as you want. So if you're worried about and our battle continues,
I feel as though you also really don't want to see that in a romance series, that people find that extra frustrating. I feel like people find it frustrating no matter what, but in a romance series, it's so terrible.
It's good that you mentioned it, because I feel like Yankee Kun to Megane-chan has an ending that would make Makoto Shinkai clap his hands for its ambiguity. Whereas I feel like in response, she's like, no questions!
And there are certain times to do it. Fine, Makoto Shinkai can do it because that's sort of the style, but wacky comedy romance? No, you don't get to just do this at the end. That's not what you were doing, and that's not fair, and nobody was looking forward to that.
So, spoilers,
they wrap it up. Good.
But yeah, the whole thing with the two new sets of witches, they basically, like, wrap that up as quickly as possible and, like, address, like, some of the important parts of the witches. But I feel like there was a lot more story to that that just kind of gets truncated and they just kind of cut to the heart. Essentially, they make it a lot more about Sarashi, which I think it always was, but to basically the detriment of all the other characters and all the other players. In a way, I feel like she was like, all right, I have like X amount of time. Fuck all y'all. Sarashi and Yamada is the key to this story. And thereby, everybody else, you get ring checks. But like you said, I think that's really, in a series like this, the critical element. And I think it's also helped a bit by the time skip that incorporates a lot of the other characters. So at least you get a feeling of what a lot of the, you know, characters you care about are doing after high school. Because it's also like I think it's like a 10-year time skip. So, you know, it's looking in on them as working adults. So I feel like that doesn't erase all the problems of that, but at least it takes a little bit of the edge off of it, which I think is greatly appreciated. I know one of the questions you asked, does everybody get paired off? There's definitely some, especially since it ends 10 years later, there are definitely certain characters who have become couples or married or stuff like that. But not everybody. But they do, like, there are three or four, like, main couples by the end of the manga.
My other question is, how emotional did you feel the ending was? Because I haven't read the last arc of the series, but there were some really emotional moments in the original arc, and I thought the series had a lot of heart, and sometimes very surprising how much depth there was to characters' feelings. So how emotional did you feel like the ending was?
I thought it was pretty strong. I think it has some interesting questions about losing yourself in a relationship, which I think is very interesting, and kind of the value of separation and reintegration, which I think is, I think becomes a very important theme at the end. Not that it wasn't already a theme, but I really feel like she drives that point home. It really, at the end, in the brass tacks, comes down to what happens to Sarashi, what happens to Yamada, how do they work out their, you know, their problems and their feelings. And I think in that regard, it's the most important thing. You know, I think it was a critical but successful triage, but know that triage had to be done. This episode's food for thought. I think both of us have been thinking a lot about Zelda, keep from playing it, and I've just been listening to a lot of videos because I find the commentary about Legend of Zelda really interesting and what it kind of says about modern game development. So my question is, a lot of people feel that Zelda is both a return to form and yet an integration of a lot of new ideas to the franchise. What game series would you like to see kind of get this Zelda treatment of kind of a bit of a rebirth? Listen to our song! To the food for thought. All right, so the food for thought is, if, like Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, you could reboot and kind of get back to the classics while adding some new material, a game series, which game series would it be? Another good example is a lot of people feel that Resident Evil 7 has done that. Not that either of us would have picked that one, but I feel like,
spoilers, Al,
Resident Evil 6, like, people super hated that game, and like, they feel like it totally went off the rails, and 7 really kind of gets back to what people have liked about 7, while once again adding some new mechanics that people really like.
I actually found this question to be, it's a great question, and then I found it really hard to answer, but I was trying to think of a game where it had a world that I really wanted to explore in a, almost in a similar way, where exploration could be part, a big part of it. And I actually came up with Donkey Kong Country, which is nothing like an exploration game, but it has such a colorful world. I think that was always one of the strong points. It has great bosses. And I feel like the team up mechanic in there was really cool, but never fully explored, because usually in each game, one of the characters ended up being so much better to use than the other ones. But the thing I always found to be really cool, at least in theory, was, like, in the first game, when you had Donkey and Diddy at the same time and you were playing using both characters and using them in unique ways. So I think it could be really cool if they did a better job of making the team part of it and controlling a team as being a central focus, and then getting to see that amazing world.
For some reason, and this has nothing to do with anything, all I could think is in that old original Nintendo Ninja Turtles game, how, like, Donatello was the only good one to use and the other three were just complete garbage fires. But, I mean, that game,
it was never that bad.
That game is, like, infamously bad for so many different reasons that is just one of its crimes. But the thing I was going to ask is, did you ever play Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze? Because, like, they made after the original set. Recently, they made one, I think one or two new Donkey Kong Country games. But I don't think they really innovated as much as, like, they were a kind of return to form, if I remember correctly. So I was just curious if you had played those, because I haven't either.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the more recent ones, or I have not played them myself. But yeah, they seem, I just feel like there's enough of a world there that they could go a little bit beyond just being a fun platformer. Sort of how I think that they've been able to innovate, and because they care and it's such a huge franchise for them, with Mario. Like, each iteration is obviously has the core concept, but sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't in adding new elements. But I think most people agree that stuff like Mario Galaxy was really an excellent addition.
No, yeah, definitely. Like,
but I feel like they don't really care that much about Donkey Kong Country, because obviously Mario's Mario. But something kind of like that. That's what I'd like to see.
No, I totally get what you're saying. I was curious if you had played the games and had an opinion. I'm not sure mine is possible how it is, but I'll throw it out there. It's not like we're, you know, pitching an idea and trying to get investors. So
this isn't Shark Tank.
Yeah, this isn't, yeah, video game Shark Tank. But a series that really kind of means a bit to me and a lot of other people, and like, if in best case scenario you could get a Breath of the Wild, is I'd really like to see the Ultima games.
I knew you were gonna say this. I knew it.
Wow, interesting. Yeah, no, I mean, I think I've complained about this on the podcast before, that in the few times that we talk about video games, that like, oh, you can complain all you want about EA screwing over Mass Effect, and that's valid. I'm not saying that your feelings are not real and not worth consideration. But know that EA stamped from hell's heart at the 9-game series of Ultima much more, because it was like a fabled, like, series that, like, so inspired both American RPGs and Japanese RPGs. It, like, is considered a granddaddy of both of them and has influences on both of them. And, like, Ultima 4 is considered so innovative because you're really trying to read a book and create, like, an ethical system. And there is no big evil. I think there is a monster you have to fight. But the purpose isn't to defeat that monster. It's to read, basically, and get this ethical system. And, like, they made so many innovations over the years. And it was this beloved franchise. And then EA came in, and 8 and 9 just were complete and utter just poopsies.
EA is evil.
And like, just the like, they turned 8 into trying to make it into this, like, action RPG hybrid, and was just bad platforming and, like, missed the mark. And then 9 was just all that in overdrive, and then that became the ending to this, like, 9 game, like, multiple, like, always, like, usually award-winning, like, innovative game series. I feel like if you could, like, license rescue that game, or, like, get a good team on there and go back to the basics of the Avatar and Britannia, and, like, add in, like, you know, Skyrim style, because if you look at Ultima 7, there was very nascent seeds of what would make those games, because you could, in Ultima 7, you could go out and you could pretty technically go almost anywhere. I mean, there were some story locks to certain areas, but, and you could get all these quests, and, like, it's basically what people like about a lot of the modern open world games. And I feel like taking in what people like about modern Western RPGs, but kind of taking the great world and characters and systems that were in the original Ultima games, I feel like that's a series that really could benefit from that.
So you mentioned that in the Ultima series, it's not about beating the boss. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like they would be able to adhere to that?
That was more Ultima 4 than anything else. I mean, like, the first three Ultima games are definitely about beating a boss. Ultima 7, you know, introduces the Guardian, who's supposed to kind of be this big boss that would kind of, and like they were building up stuff in 7, then EA took over and...
So it would lead to some great...
Well, it's...
Battle?
The ultimate question is, we don't know, because it seemed
that's
like...
That's a tragedy!
Because it looked like it was building up to, like, this ethical battle of, like, you questioning the virtues that had been built up over the first 6 games, in a way, and, like, you wonder if you would actually fight the Guardian in the 9th game, like, and I don't want to even go into it, but this isn't an Ultima podcast of how they ended Ultima 9 and, like, how they just... So, anyhow, like, they actually kind of do that in the last one, but in, like, the worst possible way. And so it's just super horrible. But, I mean, I think the idea was that they actually made... They did innovations, like having a game where the thing wasn't to beat a monster. It was to read this book and build an ethical system. And, like... And some of the other games did, like, interesting things. Or, like, you know, one of the games, like, you fight these demons and find out that they just wanted the book because they have, like, a different religion kind of based on the book. And it was, you know... And, it's coming to, like, an ethical solution at the end. You have to fight, once again, you have to fight a boss monster, but it isn't about defeating that monster. It's coming into an understanding to these these things that you originally think are monsters, but are just essentially kind of this other race that lives underground that has their own kind of religion and ethical system that's actually kind of based on the same book as yours, so... So there was some a lot of good things about that series that I feel like are worth salvaging. And I think would actually go, if given a little update, would work great with kind of how gamers work today and how gamers kind of want more than just... In certain cases, want more than just good guy versus bad guy. Although there's still a place for that kind of game and people still like that. But I feel like...
But you made me think of that game where you can choose not to fight things.
Undertale.
Where you can, like, talk mm-hmm. things out or mm-hmm. whatever instead of... So it feels like it would be received well.
Yeah, I feel like, once again, taking stuff from, like, Undertale and, like, and other more modern RPGs who have had good ideas and reintegrating them back into the Ultima series that kind of laid those seeds would be great. And I have one other one that just popped into my head. Almost kind of similar formula. I'd love to see the Heroes Class / Quest for Glory series, which was an old Sierra game series. Especially since they just did a, like, reboot of the original King's Quest games. Which was this... It's kind of an adventure game RPG mix. So it was kind of like a point-and-click puzzle adventure. But... You could pick your character, so you could be a thief, a mage, or a fighter, and each of them could progress through the games and solve the puzzles in the games in the way of their class. And they usually had some kind of side story that only that class could do in the game. And you'd also build up stats, but you'd have, you know, puzzle click, or at some points, you know, typing in words, puzzles to solve. And that was another one that had a bunch of... games, and then Sierra was bought by a different company and the games went downhill, and so, like, this series that was, you know, one game for each season and all the stuff, and then they added in another game and that was pretty okay, but then the last game was just garbage and it just ruined this really beloved series. And I think the idea of having, like, both an RPG and a puzzle adventure isn't something you see a lot. But if you could redo that series and once again add in some fresh mechanics, because I feel like Telltale Games have really innovated the, like, adventure game genre, and obviously the RPG genre has had lots of iterations, and that unique hybrid, since there's been so many innovations in the two forms of games that their hybrid game could really benefit from both ends being, you know, having so much work done on them. Plus, I'd really just like to see that series get the proper ending that it deserved, as opposed to the Poop Smith ending that it did get.
You just want to pull all the PC adventure games out. Just keep naming them. Al, well, how did you forget Leisure Suit Larry? I mean, did it really ever get the proper ending?
I was about to say, you know what's funny? Now that you just randomly mentioned it, I've seen like 4 people now go back and do like Let's Plays of Space Quest.
That was the other one I was about to bring up. All of them.
I was about to say, I feel like Space Quest has really got, like, everybody's kind of gone back and gone, oh man, the Space Quest games were really, like, funny and innovative for their time. Like, I wonder how much somebody is like, how did she know we were going to remake Space Quest?
It's the hive mind.
Mm-hmm. The most fascinating news and conversations from this month.
Okay, so since we recently did an article and watched the anime Tamago shorts from 2016, we thought we'd talk a little bit about the new ones that have been announced for 2017. And we have a lot of information, which I don't remember if... I feel like earlier in the projects... You just have a title and maybe the studio, but now they're giving you a lot more. We have all these character designs and whole plot summaries, which is very nice.
Because, yeah, what I linked to, because if you've read, which you should, the review of the anime Tamago 2016 shorts, they just had basically the names and maybe like a key visual. But, yeah, now we have, as Kate said, a lot more information. And so... I think you're a little more informed of, you know, which ones you should be looking out for. Maybe bugging people to either get streaming or at least maybe fan subbed.
We're definitely still pushing for streaming, but in a way, all this information in English gives me a little hope that someone is considering it or people are getting more interested in the project as it goes along. And... a lot of them look really good. So there's four every year. And the cutest one is definitely this Animal Island Adventure one. It's so, 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 so adorable.
I do have to say that I guess the only way I could put it is conspiracy theory, although it's not usually as toxic as most conspiracy theories. But are they like, is there some kind of secret mandate that they must have an animal one every year? And so far, all the animal ones have been good to at least okay. So it's nothing really like sinister about it. They're usually pretty entertaining and they tend to be generally kid friendly. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's just weird that is like the one consistent thing every year. They have one that has anthropomorphic animals.
And in the case of 2016, there were two.
True.
And one of them was my absolute favorite. I thought it was the best one. But I find it interesting mostly because there isn't a ton of anime that's animal-based, at least a lot of it that we don't get to see. There's some movies and some really young children's shows, and those are two things that we pretty much never get to see on the U.S. side.
Kate, are you totally ignoring K.O. Beast?
Yes.
I see.
I'm not saying there aren't any. But I know Jewel Pet, okay? I just makes me excited that
I run the number one dual pen chat site on the internet.
We're gonna get sued, Al, because the person who runs that site is gonna listen to this and be really upset.
I run the number one dual pen site. How dare that kid try to steal my crown?
I guess I'm mostly excited because I often don't get to watch these types of shorts, or shows. And I really like that Anime Tamago seems to be going in a more kid or family oriented direction. Although there is still, it feels like there's usually one that's a little more mature in one sense or the other. But especially the last couple of years, it seems like they've made an effort to have things that are more family-oriented as well in the project.
Or at least have one or two of them be like a family-friendly, forward-facing one.
So that one looks super cute. Then there's one that is about a traveling acting troupe or whatever. Or no, but they're also foxes. They're a traveling group.
And like a girl finds out that they're foxes, and so she like requests that they, you know, so she doesn't reveal their secret. They let her mom see the cherry blossoms, or grandmother see the cherry blossoms before she dies. So that seems like an interesting little story.
And it looks, again, family oriented. And the art style is really cool because it's definitely more of like a 60s throwback. And I feel like it's the style is such a throwback that it's not what you would expect, because I feel as though we see a lot of 70s in people, you know, that was a really interesting time, and a lot of people were really influenced by a lot of the 70s style. And obviously the 60s was really important for anime, but I just don't feel like you see a lot of throwback to it as much as some of the other eras, so I thought that was cool, or that seems cool about it. Then there's one, there's always got to be some, like, total garbage one, which is this, I don't know, titty ninja, whatever, whatever it is.
It's like, yeah, they're ninjas, and they're cute girls, and they're fighting over Edamame.
I guess they're
beans.
Not ninjas, but they're all, like, well, some of them are ninjas, and they're all wearing stupid outfits.
Because they're fighting over, one wants to make them, like, roasted Edamame, and one wants to make them natto, and they're sending assassins after each other, and there's some third faction, which I'm sure if I knew, like, what you can make out of Edamame beans, I could tell you what the third faction girl would be, but also who gives a flying.
Yeah, it just kind of looks eh. And then there's the super weird thing here is that Reddish is going to be a short in this. If that name sounds familiar to you, it's because it was a crowdfunding project in 2015 that garnered some controversy, and then nothing ever came of it.
Because it was supposed to be what they were going to work on after they finished Mighty No. 9. But Mighty No. 9, people were already like a little getting worried about it.
And it was dragging on and on.
And they're like, so you haven't finished it. And now things are beginning to look south about the production. And now you want us to fund another game that has less, like, less demoed material and funded anime for it at the same time. And that did not go over well. And yeah, that Kickstarter failed. And then they tried to split.
Oh, so it didn't get funded?
Oh, I don't remember if it got funded, but I remember, like, it then got split into separate ones where they tried to fund the game and the anime. And that, if any of it got funded, which I don't think it did, it did not go well. Because, and then I think most people just totally forgot about it after the messy garbage pile that was the Mighty No. 9 that was released.
I was just really shocked to see it on here. So now it is finally getting this short that presumably was the point of the whole, it's odd, I think.
Yeah, no, it'll be interesting to see what they pull out of that, considering, once again, how badly Mighty No. 9 and Red Ash have gone. What studio is working on it?
4C.
I mean, 4C is a pretty damn reliable studio. They might be able to spring, you know. I do not doubt that they can, in best case scenario, spin straw into gold. But it will be a bit of a task to make that into something good. So I'm going to watch it like we do everything else, but I'm going to have tempered expectations, even if it is Studio 4C.
The interesting thing about it is having any expectation, because the project is usually so focused on new ideas, new directors, young talent, that sort of thing, that I feel like you don't have any expectation. It's all new. Mm-hmm. Maybe we have expectations now because we've watched many of the years of the projects, mm-hmm. but...
Well, that's what I was more saying, that I'm usually... I know that it's, once again, as I've said about any kind of anthology series, it's hit or miss, but I always feel like a lot of times at least they try something.
But I'm saying I feel that's what makes Red Ash so odd is mm-hmm. that we have prior knowledge going into something, which is not the usual place that you're coming at these shorts of, mm-hmm. except maybe when there's a director that you've sort of heard of a little bit, maybe. Mm-hmm. But nothing with this much baggage.
Oh, yeah, no, this is definitely... Like, the only thing would be, like, somebody who was, like, disgraced and, like, coming back to the industry. That's, like, the only situation I could think of that would have the equal amount of, like, ooh, wow, this is going to be interesting. With interesting in, you know, heavy rapid quotes.
So definitely worth mentioning is the Anime Industry 100th Anniversary Streaming Project that's going on. So it'll be going on for the rest of the year, runs through the end of 2017. And Japanese website has been putting up these classic animated works, many of which have never been seen before. And they actually have English subtitles. And the... A&N article has instructions on how to navigate the website if you need some help with it. They're showing things like the oldest anime that they have, like, unearthed, which is this one from 1917, and it's called Namakura Gantana. And I haven't watched it yet, but I'm very excited about this project. And they said that they're going to be putting up, like, more than 50 shows for everybody to see. So it's a really unique opportunity to see some classic anime and to get a little bit of history into your anime viewing.
Because I remember a year or two back, Gerald really, from Anime World Order, they had a box set of, like, some anime from that time. And it was, like, very expensive. And you had to, like, basically get it from a Japanese website. And I remember one of, you know, any Twitter people talking about it. And then that, like, kind of disappeared. And it's now become, like, kind of a collector's item for a very select part of the anime community. And so I'm not sure how much of these... I'm sure that at least some of those titles overlap. So, I mean, yeah. It's not for, you know... If all you care about is what's the new shows on, you know, this season, probably a lot of this stuff is very crude and just trying to experiment with the form. But the average person who listens to the Speakeasy, this is probably a lot more of an interest because this is, like, once again, is everything going to be here? Great. No. A lot of it is, you know, very crude and not that great. But it's super valuable insight into the foundations of the form and, you know, what these, like, kind of almost... seemingly lost for the longest time influences. I mean, for the longest time, how many people thought that, like, Astro Boy was the first anime ever? And then you go back and you see that there were, like, literally, over 100 anime before that. I mean, some of them were just little short, you know, 10, 15-minute experiments, but this, you know, we've over the years, both in Japan and here, have, like, unearthed this kind of, like, very important foundation of what would become modern anime.
And anime, the industry is 100 years old. Makes me feel old. Because, you know, I've been watching anime since the beginning.
Ah, yes.
I feel like a lot of people feel like they've really been watching it from the beginning, but this should put in a little bit of, like, perspective for most people.
I saw the first anime. It's just getting a Blu-ray right now. Outlaw Star.
Oh, you know there's some kid on Facebook. Oh, man. All right. Oh, so this I just wanted to mention real quick because I'm kind of curious about it, is that Netflix is doing an original Japanese series, Erased, into live action, and it says it's going to be available in 190 countries, and I don't know if we're going to be one of them, but that would be cool, right?
In the past, if it wasn't Netflix, I'd be a little like, I'll believe it when I see it. Because, you know, how many titles, I mean, supposedly there was supposed to be that Monster TV series, and I still haven't seen.
Oh, yeah, but if Netflix said they're doing it, it's like, it's already casted.
No. That, I was like, but when Netflix says, like, yeah, it's going to be there, you're like, oh, so is it going to be next season or two seasons from now?
Yeah.
They tend to be really.
They're like, oh, actually, it's in the next 5 minutes.
So I'm like, oh, all right. So, once again, my question is it going to be next season or two seasons from now?
But yeah, from the article, it doesn't say whether or not, you know, it's going to be in the U.S., but hopefully that would be great.
The fandom of that show became very mixed by the end. I feel like it seems like a very smart show to make into a live-action kind of title. Once again, kind of like when people are like, oh, Monster got picked up. Yeah, that's a smart choice. Once again, we didn't see how that turned out, but it seemed like a logical choice. Same thing with Erased.
Although, I think Erased is a little bit more difficult because of them being children. And the casting, from what I saw, is only the adult characters so far. And most of the series actually takes place with them being kids, so I'm a little bit curious.
Oh, I didn't say it would be good. I just thought it was true. I see what you get.
But I just mean that that's going to be such a huge portion of whether or not it's good is who. And just seeing a picture of a kid is not going to help me know if they're going to be a good actor. That is irrelevant. But, you know, so much of the biggest drama, except for the first episode, really takes place when they're children, so.
Right.
And, I mean, the ending is when they're adults, but the bulk of the story.
Yeah, if 90% of your acting is horrible, you're not going to be like, the boy, that first and last episode were really well acted.
It's like, would you get to the last episode? I don't know. So, and you know what? The other thing about the series, and I think I could see it going over really well, though, especially because it has a really good mystery. It has a real creepy, scary suspense portion to it. But also that part is so much made, I think will be made scarier by it being live action or possibly less scary and cheesy. I don't know. But either way, I'm very interested in seeing. And I know they're also making a movie, but I don't know how many episodes we need of us complaining about how we never get movies.
Yeah, no. I just, once again, I was just, when I saw the Netflix, I was like, all right, well, good or bad, we'll find out pretty quick.
That's true. Okay, so a lot of Crunchyroll kind of announcements the last month. One that we don't know a whole heck of a lot about yet, as far as I know, is the Anime Movie Night. And this is really just a partnership kind of thing. But they are teaming up to do these theatrical one-night events maybe every month across the country. And they'll be showing, I don't know. That's the thing, is that we don't know. It says a series of theatrical screenings of anime episodes or films. Well, so that could, I mean, that could be anything.
So I have a few thoughts about that. One, Fathom Events, kind of, especially with digital distribution, makes a lot of these, hey, would you be willing to run this film like one night or maybe two or three nights in your theater? And a lot of theaters are a lot more conducive since it's pretty easy to get the files. And then, you know, you just pick a slow night for the theater and, you know, take out one of your underperforming movies, throw in, you know, the Fathom Event movie. And, you know, you get maybe a different audience than you would normally get for the theater. So a lot of people win in that scenario. And so, yeah, that's why I think you see so many more anime movies coming to theaters. So it just makes sense, especially since Crunchyroll has been doing a lot of partnerships. I mean, the whole Funimation thing. And it seems a pretty smart idea. And the other thing I was thinking of, we have an Alamo Draft House in Brooklyn. And for the last month or so, they've just been playing, like, Studio Ghibli movies. They'll usually have, like, one night we'll have, like, the dub version, and then the other night we'll have the sub version. And they've been kind of going through the whole Disney slash Ghibli catalog. Basically any of the movies that Disney has released over here, and thereby have a sub and a dub in their theaters. So I'm wondering if they might also go back and this is just pure speculation, and go back and get some, like, you know, a little more back catalog movies for this as well. And then kind of like what they've done with the Jim Lee Knight, you know, like, you know, the Cowboy Bebop movie would be, you know, one that I'm sure would be popular. Maybe the Trigun movie, that's a little more recent, but still something you could pop out. And then also premiere some, you know, did not air that, you know, did not play that long ago in Japan movies as well.
I just think it's interesting that it seems to be a separate from Funimation. So Cowboy Bebop movie, Trigun movie, those are Funimation.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be somehow separate from that. And there's also this piece about anime episodes, which seems like a really weird thing. And they did a teaser video, which was Nanbaka, Bungo Stray Dogs, Blood of Wars, and Soul Buster. Now, I know Bungo Stray Dogs is getting a movie, but it doesn't have a movie yet. So I'm almost like a little confused about mm-hmm. what they'll be showing, because what, are you just going to show the first episode of a show?
I guess. I'm not really down to go see that in a movie theater.
Unless they did a special, like specials that you can't see, or I'd be interested in seeing the Kuroko's compilation movies, the Yomushi stuff, but I'm not quite sure what it's really going to be. It says the first event will be in April, so I guess we'll know fairly soon.
And I was about to say, also, Aniplex does their own movie, so it's probably not going to, unless they have some kind of partnership, and probably not going to be any of their stuff. Because, like, there's some stuff that would be, like, if you were like, hey, we're going to play the Hayate movie in theaters, my ticket is right there, because... But if you're like, here's some Hayate episodes, I can just go and watch it on... Like, I mean, the Hayate movie is the greatest movie of all time. But at least it has a bit of theatrical quality that would be worth going and paying how much money to see in the theater. But a regular Hayate episode, I love Hayate.
Or like a bunch of random episodes of a bunch of shows back to back or something. What's the point of that?
Oh, yeah, like, oh, I like two of those shows, and then two of those shows are like... You're like, oh, I'd love to watch two of those shows, but then, what do you call it? My maid butler vampire.
Maybe everybody's just going to heckle. That's the whole point of the event.
And I know the minute you're like, oh, so it's going to be amateur MST3K hour. I know a lot of people would
peace
be like,
out. Oh,
thank you. I did not want to experience hell early.
Another piece of Crunchyroll news is that they're getting their own convention.
Well, it's interesting because they've kind of been partnering with a bunch of conventions, and they've had like a system where you can like show Crunchyroll shows in basically your screening rooms at conventions. So they've had a presence. Like the one that took over Anime Next Old Space, that was like not fully Crunchyroll, but they had a, you know, at least like a decent like third or fourth of a hand in that one. But this is like, all right, here's a convention and we are pretty much, you know, the showrunners behind it. So they've kind of kicked up from just kind of like a little bit of sponsorship to, you know, running their whole the whole show, as it were. It's just the only thing that I kind of remember being similar other than like Expo, but that's Anime Expo, but that's kind of a different beast completely, is the Big Apple Anime Fest, how that was like several anime companies coming together to make a convention.
But in this case, this is, they're always present, like you said, mm-hmm. Al, at all these conventions, but this one is run by them, partnering with Left Field Media, and it's also in California in the summer, like California needs another convention in the summer. But they've also said that the convention will be based on stuff like BlizzCon, PAX, E3. So first of all, those things are video game things, so I don't know exactly what they mean by
setting
them up in a similar way. I'm like, you know, right, that you are, this is anime? I don't know.
It's like, it's so weird because those, I mean, I know what they're trying to invoke, but like E3 is this weird dying man of the video game convention. And like BlizzCon is very specific. It's like, we are one studio and we cater to the fans of the games of our studio in like a way that a normal convention can't. It's like, it would be like a Star Trek convention if it was run by Paramount. That's how like BlizzCon is. And I'm not saying that BlizzCon isn't fun, but it's a very particular kind of convention that could only be run by Blizzard. Or basically by the people who are producing the content that the con is about. And then PAX is the only one that kind of makes sense as an analogy, but it's very different than an anime convention. And I mean, PAX, we've both been to one. It's very fun, but it's very different than how you'd run an anime convention. So are they going to run this convention like PAX? That would be interesting,
I guess, I'm
not sure how compatible it is.
Yeah, that's what I mean, is that the comparisons are, I just don't know what to expect, because PAX, one of the major components there is like, you're playing games, you've got the indie game scene that you're demoing games or hearing about. There's just such an interaction that's very different than the way you interact with anime at an anime. I'm saying I don't know how you replicate that.
Yeah, and they have such an industry fan convergence, because so, like you said, you have so many big companies sending representatives to do panels in a way that you only see at something like a New York or San Diego Comic-Con.
I guess Expo, mm-hmm. also.
Yeah. And you have, like you said, such a vibrant indie scene that, like, you don't really see anywhere else other than some, like, very niche, smaller video game conventions. And, yeah, but it still has a big fan thing. So it's an interesting, once again, like, but that's one of the three examples. And, like, it's, if you were going to model yourself and actually you just didn't throw out names to throw out names.
Like, here's things that people know.
Yeah. I feel like they're probably the best one to base your model on, but I'm not sure how that's going to work.
I loved PAX when I went to it. Obviously, very successful conventions. I just don't know how it translates to anime, is basically my point.
And like I said, the other two make absolutely no sense.
Oh, they also mention South by Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
But I also don't know anything about that con, so.
Yeah, no. Isn't that a film fest?
Yeah, film and music industries.
Yeah, I mean, that one's like, I mostly know it for like debuting films there, like a Cannes type thing. Now I know, just from listening to Elliot Page and some of the English anime fans, that they have some prestigious cons that are basically like, here are some, almost like anime versions of the New York International Children's Film Festival, where there'll be like a few days where they'll play like 8 new movies. And so I guess that's another model that could kind of work if like they debuted a lot of, especially if they're doing the anime movie night, if they got Your Name and Ancient and the Magic Tablet. And, you know, even though I don't care, I think it would be, you know, to have like the Sword Art movie and a few other.
Adding to what you're saying, Al, maybe it's something where there's going to be a lot more focus on watching anime together. Because that is what you use Crunchyroll for, and that's how you interact with the product. Because that's what I feel like, that's what I was trying to say about PAX, is there's like this interaction with the product that you're there to see. I didn't spend I spent some time in panels there, but not a lot. There was a lot more gaming and doing things related to games, so maybe, I don't know. We're not going to go to the first one, so people will report back. I'm sure it'll all be streamed or whatever. All right, now on to the pissed off news about Crunchyroll that everybody's mad about, that everybody's yelling about, as they should be. But Crunchyroll's released a statement, so.
I remember from what little I popped in on a Twitter, I was like, man, everybody's really mad at Crunchyroll.
So in case you don't use Crunchyroll, which I honestly, as an anime fan, don't even know how that's possible anymore, but totally possible. And or you weren't using it last weekend, or a couple weekends ago by the time this podcast comes out, everybody who was watching noticed a massive slowdown. I feel like their statement about it has to do with the quality of video, which there was a quality problem, but I also had trouble loading, period. It wasn't just, oh, this video quality is bad, which it was, but just getting the site to function was a huge problem. And there was having to reload a lot, waiting forever, even if you were downgrading your video, it wasn't as if, oh, well, everybody's watching 1080 and it just wasn't happening, which can happen sometimes. But this was a massive slowdown that people took notice of.
At first, you know, you might think, oh, denial of service attack. It's happened before. It's happened to bigger, more robust companies, you know.
And I think it's happened to Crunchyroll before.
So, you know, it would make logical sense. But then it came out that, oh, no, this was, like, purposeful. This wasn't, like, some accident or some malicious outside group, you know, deciding that, oh, I'm going to kick some dirt in this face of these anime fans.
So the crux of the issue was that they're transitioning over to this new infrastructure, and doing so messed up a whole bunch of stuff, essentially. And they've said that they've corrected the problem for new episodes. So going forward, you shouldn't theoretically see any problems with videos. But it sounds like the back catalog is going to take 10,000 years, approximately, to get updated enough so that it runs at its normal quality on this new infrastructure. So anything past, like, a couple weeks old at this point, you may see problems with. I'm more concerned with the site itself was running really badly. So they did not address that in their statement about it, so I'm concerned about that as well.
I mean, I don't think we've talked about it on the podcast or the blog, but they had all those layoffs recently, and like
it's real shame.
And they really reduced their staff, and I know it got a lot of people going, and so like I feel like if you had any kind of conspiracy theories about, or like just speculation about, I wonder if this will lead to a degradation of quality. Well, yeah, I don't know. There's some validity to your suspicions with this one.
Yeah, I think everybody's really concerned, especially because Crunchyroll, even before this point, has been pretty slow to respond to feedback. Not just for them to answer you, but to actually do stuff and update the site. There was so many things that never got updated in apps for the site, and you know, it took them forever. Even if you watched on the web and not using an app, there was a whole bunch of things that were problems, which they've I think fixed at this point. But there's just a long lead time for changes, and so I think a lot of us are concerned that that's going to get worse going forward.
Especially now that they've teamed up with Funimation, who was never the stars of the streaming world as it was. So now they have, like, basically two catalogs to shift through, and now they have less staff.
There's just a lot of speculation also going on at this point about if the service is going to change at all, if there's going to be ads, if there's going to be some sort of premium on streaming higher quality or streaming without ads, things like that. None of that we know yet, so no, not throwing out any. Don't panic.
But, I mean, it's happened with even like Hulu and other, you know, once again, big sites. So the fact I feel like the streaming market is still in no way a solved problem for the entertainment industry, even on the high, you know, super mass market. So anime, which is this little niche, doubly so.
That wraps up another Speakeasy podcast. Remember to visit reversethieves.com for all kinds of content to tide you over until the next episode.